From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in the program, we'll talk about wildlife conservation with Will Travers, head of Born Free USA. Also, the complicated, sometimes contradictory roles of women in the Bible. And On a Narrow Windowsill, a new book of poems and stories all written like tweets in 140 characters or less. But first, what impact is California's budget crisis having on the state's public schools? In recent weeks on Insight, we've checked in with several local school superintendents and found plenty of concern. They said they've already made deeper budget cuts than they could have imagined, and last month sent out a lot of pink slips to teachers and other staff who might have to be let go. How it all ends up depends on the state budget, but it could be many months before one is passed. Today we'll talk with California's top schools official, State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Tom Torlakson. Superintendent, welcome to the program.
Good day. Good morning.
Well, when you look at the general state of California schools, given the state's budget problems, what's the thing that most concerns you?
Well, we're in a terrible situation. As you are aware, I declared a state of financial emergency for California schools back in January, and that's with the hope that the governor's budget would reach agreement in the legislature and we could have a bipartisan solution that would continue to fund critically needed dollars going into the schools. Now that has not happened, so we're in even a worse emergency than previously. I can give you the details of what that looks like, but it's really not the dream that California has for our schools.
Well, just a couple of weeks ago, you sent out a letter to the state school districts advising them to plan for the worst. What does the worst mean?
Well, the worst at this point means an additional $4.5 billion of cuts on top of $18 billion the schools have endured over the last 3 years. They've lost in those last three budgets one-third of their total funding for kindergarten through high school, and now another 10% cut is threatened if we don't get an extension of the current taxes that are now going into our schools, which were put there as an investment in the midst of this crisis to help shore up class sizes and learning the equipment we need in the schools, all that makes a high school and middle school and elementary school education so important and so vital.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that with the partial state budget that's so far in place, which is for the most part cuts only, the public school system has gotten off, quote-unquote, relatively lightly, and there could be a lot worse to come if the budget has to be balanced entirely with cuts.
Well, I'd say this, Jeffrey, that they really haven't come off that lightly because they're suffering from the previous 3 years of cuts where taking away one-third of the funding, seeing class sizes go from 22 to 28 to 30, 32. We have many, many classrooms in California at the max at 40 students per classroom. And we have to think of education as a continuum. I'm also a regent with UC. I'm a CSU trustee for the great California State Universities. They are doing $1.5 billion of cuts. We're telling students, work hard, get eligible to go to college, and now we may turn away tens of thousands of students that want to go into higher education, but there will be no room. We're seeing the dropout rate go up already. So we are in a crisis, not just in K-12, but I also believe at our universities level.
My guest is Tom Torlakson, California State Superintendent of Public Instruction. Until a few months ago, you were a state lawmaker yourself. How do you think it's going to turn out, the state budget?
Well, I am still hopeful that the legislature will come together in a bipartisan way. You know, a political setback was had here in the last few days since a deadline to meeting a June ballot election, giving the voters a chance to debate this topic. That deadline came and went. We're past the chance of a June election. So now we must turn to the legislature itself to do its job, to basically stand up for the kids of California, for the future of our economy, for the future of our democracy. So we can't let a political setback be an excuse for shortchanging our students. It is a political setback that there wasn't the agreement, but we must redouble our efforts, and the public needs to get engaged and talk to their legislators up and down the state of California and urge them to do the right thing for the kids of California.
Well, back to the districts. As I said, you advised them to plan for the worst. Are they doing that? Are you aware of any school districts that are maybe in denial about what's going on?
Well, they are, generally speaking, planning for the worst. You know, 30,000 jobs of teachers were lost in the last 3 years prior to this year, and probably 15,000 classified employees who do a lot to keep a school running. They're the techs that fix the computers. They prepare the food. They transport the students to school. They provide safety on campus. They keep the clerical side of the world moving. They lost 15,000. And it's not just a loss of jobs, which is important in itself, but this is the reality of these hardworking people helping kids learn and being in front of kids in the classroom. 30,000 of those talented teachers have left. And now 20,000 additional pink slips have been issued. And if there is not a legislative solution by the beginning of June, we would see another 20,000 teachers leaving and classes get even more crowded. The school year has been shortened already to one of the shortest school years in the industrialized modern world. You know, our competitors in Finland, China, Shanghai, India, they have school years that are much longer. Ours was reduced by 1 week in the last couple of years and maybe reduced by 2 or 3 weeks more.
Just a couple of weeks ago, your department released the results of the first semi-annual interim status report on budget certifications for California's local educational agencies. And as part of that report, you announced that nearly 2 million students, which is roughly 30% of the pupils in California, now attend a school in a district facing serious financial jeopardy. Where could that end up? What's the worst-case scenario in those districts?
Well, the worst-case scenario is a reality. We've already had, as a state of California, to take over districts that are essentially bankrupt, that they have run out of funds. They have gotten to a state where they cannot continue, and then the state is asked to bail them out, which means emergency allocations from the general fund of the state of California. It makes no sense to deal with it after the harm has been done and after the finances have unraveled. We have 110 districts that are negative or qualified in the financial assessment of where they stand today. I believe that number could double or triple here in the next 12 months if we do not get a legislative solution or some balanced response to Governor Jerry Brown's plan. And so that 2 million students could multiply to 3 to 4 million students could be in districts in serious financial jeopardy.
That could involve costs for the state of California, would it not?
Absolutely. And the question again is, where do you get the money? Because at this point, the state budget was out of balance by $27 billion. The governor, I thought, rightly said, let's take half of this gap, this budget deficit, and do cuts. And serious cuts were enacted into law and signed into law already, and it was not easy for the legislature to cut child care, to cut health and human services, but they did, and they cut transportation, they cut environmental protection, they cut a whole host of things. But where will they get the money to bail out, you know, bankrupt districts if another 10 or another 20 or another 100 go into negative certification or turn to the state for a bailout?
The state of California funds or helps to fund a wide variety of services that ultimately caters to most people, I guess maybe even everyone in California. And at times like this, when budgets are being cut across the board, all of those people who provide the services and receive the services say, this service is absolutely vital to the state of California. It's imperative that the state find the money to fully fund this. How do schools face up in that scenario? How do they justify whatever money there is still available?
Well, I believe our Constitution, I believe our history points to the fact that education is the top priority and should be funded. Recent studies just a few years ago said we should be adding $10 billion to $15 billion to the education budget to catch up with the rest of the nation. We're now 46th or 47th in the nation in per pupil investment, in the what we put in per student to educate them per year. Where previously, when I was going to school, my daughters were going to school in our great public schools at that time, we were in the top five in the nation in what we invested in. Guess what? We were also top five in the nation in what we had in results, in high test scores in math and science and language arts. Now we're at the bottom. We're 47th, 46th, 48th, any way you measure California academic achievement. And the finances have gone south, in great part causing this crisis. So I believe the public, given a chance to vote on investing in education, will do so. And time and again, when there are local measures put in front of voters, by and large throughout California, they're saying yes, because they understand fundamentally it's an investment in the future. It's our kids' future. It's our economy's future. It's our democracy's future.
If and when more money goes back into California's public schools, do you think that they could be in the long term in better shape because of efficiencies forced on them by all of this budget cutting?
Well, I'll say this, that we have teachers out there working valiantly every day, 300,000 teachers helping our 6 million students learn. And guess what? Despite the crowded classrooms, they have been succeeding and test scores have been going up, not anywhere near what they should have gone up had they been given the right equipment and the computers and the textbooks and the right size classes and the length of school year and summer school, which has now been canceled in most parts of California. But by and large, our schools have been doing well in terms of progress. I believe that we're going to have to redouble and focus. They've also done well in economic efficiency. So I'm putting a spotlight to show the public that our superintendents and school boards and teachers are squeezing every dime out of every dollar. And they're consolidating administrative functions. They're taking out assistant administrators. They're doing joint purchasing, joint vehicle maintenance. They're working in collaborative ways that weren't thought of before this crisis. So part of the infrastructure of our schools, the back office, the maintenance and operations of the school, I think we'll see a strengthening of position. It saves hundreds of millions of dollars, but that's not enough to make up the billions that have been lost in the basic funding that it is, in my opinion, the obligation of the state of California, the governor and legislature collectively, to provide to our students.
Last month, school districts across California sent out many thousands of pink slips, preliminary layoff notices. But of course, these people won't know whether or not they'll be laid off until the state budget is finalized. And as we know from past years, that could be until the fall. Do you see any changes to that system?
No. I know that we're facing this crisis, and it's a huge morale issue. It's a huge issue in terms of young people, particularly that are choosing education as a career, wanting to be teachers, passionate, equipped well with their education to help our students. They're getting pink slips now 2-3 years in a row. And this year, there's no backup plan. The federal government does not have the EduJobs money, which saved 15 to 20,000 teaching jobs last year. There is no ARRA federal bailout, economic recovery bailout this year. Reserves are gone. So most of the 20,000 who've received pink slips will actually lose their jobs. And it won't wait till the end of summer. There are deadlines by which the districts have to make these cuts. If there is not the prospect of money coming in from the legislature or the governor, they must make the cuts or they put themselves in financial jeopardy of having a payroll so big that beyond what they can actually pay for with the dollars that will come in. So I think many of these teachers will receive those final layoff notices towards the end of May. And then, unfortunately, I believe many of them will not come back to the teaching profession. I am disappointed in that, and I'm urging the legislature to do everything in its power to see that reality and really look out for the students of California.
Tom Torlakson, California State Superintendent of Public Instruction, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, we'll talk about wildlife conservation with Will Travers, head of Born Free USA. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. There you'll find lots of information about our program, including links to follow us on Facebook and me on Twitter. Coming up in Talk of the Nation, the long battle over sex discrimination at work. Last month, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in the largest sex discrimination case in U.S. history. Also, are jobs really coming back? The nation's unemployment rate fell last month to its lowest level in 2 years, but some economists warn that may not last, and a real recovery could be a long way off. Will Travers, the head of Born Free USA, the animal advocacy group, is in town. He's here for the screening of a film about endangered species. It's called Born to be Wild 3D, and the film was made for IMAX theaters. Travers is a son of the actors Bill Travers and Virginia McKenna, best known for their film Born Free and for their advocacy on behalf of animals. In the 1980s, Will Travers and his parents started an organization that became the Born Free Foundation. Born Free USA is a companion organization and headquartered in Sacramento. Well, Travers, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. Nice to see you.
Well, this film, Born to be Wild 3D, were you personally involved in making this film?
No, sadly, I wasn't. And it's a great film. I really encourage everybody to go down and see it. It's good for kids. It's good for families. There's nothing there too shocking. But it's got a very important story underlining it for both elephants and also for orangutans. And their species that Born Free is involved with, particularly elephants.
Tell us what's of concern about elephants and orangutans.
Well, what you see in the film is the work of Daphne Sheldrick. She's a famous person in Africa. She was awarded a dameship by Her Majesty the Queen for her services to conservation. And what she's done over the last 30, 40 years is rescue baby elephants that have been orphaned by the ivory trade and other human interventions. And she has uniquely found the milk formula that allows those animals to successfully be reared and then ultimately return to the wild. So that's the elephant story. And I've known Daphne since the 1970s, and she is an absolutely fantastic elephant mother, I think we should call her. And then there's Dr. Baruti Galdikas, and she is the kind of equivalent, but for orangutans. This time it's not so much about poaching, which is what the impact on elephants is. This is about palm oil plantations in Southeast Asia, which are replacing natural forest, the home of the orangutans. And therefore, you have literally hundreds of orangutan orphans that need care and need a home.
Was this woman, Dame Daphne Sheldrick, a friend or a colleague of your parents?
Sort of both. In fact, the Born Free Foundation started because of the death of an elephant at the London Zoo in 1983. That elephant had been in a film with my parents in the late 1960s. And when that film came to an end, it was filmed in Kenya, they asked the Kenya government, please, could we have this elephant and return her to the wild? Because Daphne and David Sheldrick, her husband, said they could return her to the wild. The government said, yes, but they would have to capture another elephant from an elephant family and send that as the gift to London Zoo that they'd promised. So rather than do that, Poli Poli, this little elephant, which means slowly, slowly in Swahili, went to London Zoo, and her sad death just a decade or so later was what sparked the creation of what is now the Born Free Foundation.
Will Travers, a CEO of Born Free USA, an animal advocacy group headquartered in Sacramento and affiliated with the Born Free Foundation, which is headquartered in England. You've been working on animal advocacy for quite a long time now. Are things better or worse today in general? For animals?
That's a very good question. I kind of hope that they're better. I think there's a lot more awareness. I think many of your listeners will be aware of things that 10, 15 years ago they simply wouldn't be aware of, whether we're talking about climate change, we're talking about the impact of captivity on wild animals, so animals in circuses or zoos, the inappropriateness of keeping wild animals as pets, exotic animals as pets. And we have a rescue center, Born Free USA has a rescue center for primates in Texas. We have 500 rescue primates down there that have come from roadside menageries, private individuals, laboratories, and they are the fallout of an inappropriate exploitation of wild animals by human beings.
That must get a little noisy there sometimes.
It does, but actually it's quite a big place. So, I mean, one of the enclosures alone is 50 acres and has 200 primates in it. And we try to give them, and these are damaged goods often, animals that are not socially adjusted. They're animals that have behavioral problems. They don't even know how to relate to members of their own species. So we have to go through a long process of getting them to be normal again. And then we give them as much of a normal life as we possibly can in these very large enclosures.
What about China? There are some things in China, attitudes towards animals, that people in the West, some people in the West find troubling. How has that changed attitudes towards animals, as far as you know, in China, given that China has become richer and more integrated into the rest of the world?
Well, there's a new piece of legislation in China. There's an animal welfare law that was promulgated in the middle of 2010. I don't know yet how much of an impact that's going to have, because there's always a big difference between the legislation on paper and its actual application in real life. One of the things that we're most concerned about in China is the sort of entertainment use of animals in a terminal way. And what I mean by that is you can go to a zoo in China, you can buy a cow, and you can see that cow being live fed to lions and tigers. It's a form of sort of almost Roman style animal entertainment with death as its outcome. And we've talked to the Chinese cultural attaché in London. We've been to the Chinese embassy in London. And there is an understanding, absolutely, amongst what I would call the more intellectual Chinese, that this is something that they have to get a grip on. But it's very hard to change that when there is a big public appetite for it in China. You've got to go through a long educational process at the same time as changing legislation. I mean, for us, it cannot come a moment too soon. So I hope that's one of the things that will change in the near future.
There's a related issue in California, legislation that would ban shark fin soup in California. I'm sure you're familiar with that. There is a long-standing practice of using shark fins in soup in China. Unfortunately, the way it's done is the shark's fin gets cut off and then it gets tossed back into the ocean. Mm. And some Chinese restaurants in San Francisco have objected to this legislation, but we tried to invite someone who is from that point of view onto our program when we discussed it, but they weren't willing to do so. Where do you think this is going to end up?
Well, there's probably three quick things to say about that. The first is that 100 million sharks a year are being killed for shark's fin soup. It is a completely unsustainable process. And by way of example, a few years ago, Disney Corporation was going to open, and I think it has now opened, a sort of Disneyland out in the Far East in Hong Kong. And in order to set the seal on this prestigious event, they were going to have a sit-down banquet for 1,000 people, and they were going to serve shark's fin soup. And we contacted them along with many groups and said, please don't do this, because what you're doing is you're reinforcing something that is very bad for sharks. And it's an opportunity for you to set a new agenda, being a global leader. They came back and said, well, they thought it would be culturally wrong not to serve it, but they promised that they would only serve shark's fin soup from sharks that came from sustainable shark fisheries. It all went quiet. We waited for 3 months. And the letter then came back from Disney and said, we have not been able to find a single sustainable shark fishery on the planet, and therefore we won't be serving shark's fin soup. Now, that tells me that if Disney can't find, Disney with all its resources, cannot find a single sustainable shark fishery on the planet, there is none. And that's why we should not be serving shark's fin soup. We should also not be allowing shark's fins to be landed at fish markets unless they are attached to the body of the shark.
But don't you often find yourself bumping into long-standing cultural practices where people say, well, but this is how things have been done for a long time in our society. Animals die sometimes in barbaric ways in the wild, in nature. What's the problem?
Well, it's an important point. And I raised this with an Indian spiritual guru that I met a few years ago by invitation. And I said to him, you know, what happens when a cultural tradition such as the use of tiger body parts in traditional Chinese medicine, bumps up against the fact that tigers are in terminal decline in the wild, and we now have less than 4,000 wild tigers in the world and about 1,400 left in India. And he was an Indian. And he said, then the cultural issue has to give way. And I think that's what we need. We need cultural leaders to step up and actually articulate the view that the cultural issue must not take dominance over the survival of a species, for example, like the tiger.
Another animal story that was in international news recently was the death of Knut, that young male polar bear being kept captive in Germany in a zoo. And in your blog, you wrote, his short life was a series of tragedies from start to miserable finish. What was miserable about his life?
Well, he was abandoned by his mother when he was born. So he was hand-reared. So that's not natural. He was then, his keeper who looked after him, was then denied access to him as he became bigger, possibly because it was getting too dangerous. His keeper then died, so he lost that one human connection that he had that made some kind of sense. And then, of course, he died aged 4, and polar bears can live to 30 or more, in an unnatural, artificial, human-created captive environment. There's nothing good about that story. The only good bit that came out of Knut's really short and, as I say, miserable life is that it's made people think again about whether polar bears are a species that should be in captivity or not.
Finally, Will Travers, why is it the Born Free USA is headquartered in Sacramento? The foundation, the Born Free Foundation, is in England.
It is. Born Free USA is a separate entity. We actually merged with the Animal Protection Institute that's been in Sacramento for many years. And we have a raft of very important US-centered activities that really should be prosecuted from here. For example, petitioning the Secretary of the Interior on the future of trophy hunting of lions. We're actually trying to get the Secretary of Interior to say, under the Endangered Species Act, that there should be no more trophy hunting of lions and bringing trophies into the US because it's unsustainable. We're losing 600 lions a year in the wild, and we may only have 25,000 lions in total in Africa, to the trophy hunting industry, and half of that industry comes to the United States, so we have a responsibility. The exotic animal situation that I've already talked to you about, the circuses, the use of animals in circuses. Interestingly, the UK government is right now considering an end to the use of wild animals in circuses. It'll be very interesting to see how that argument plays out here in the US.
It would indeed. Will Travers, CEO of Born Free USA, the animal advocacy group that's affiliated with the Born Free Foundation. He's in town for the screening of a film about endangered species. It's called Born to be Wild 3D. It opens on Thursday at IMAX theaters, including in Sacramento. Will Travers, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. And I do hope your listeners will go and see that show. It's fantastic.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, the complicated, sometimes contradictory roles of women in the Bible. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tomorrow's topics include, or guests rather, include the author of A 21st Century Ethical Toolbox, which is a popular college textbook on how to deal with ethical problems of our time. Back to today, the Bible seems to be a book of mixed messages when it comes to the role of women. On the one hand, you have Eve made out of one of the ribs of Adam. On the other hand, you have powerful women like Deborah in the book of Judges. How do we reconcile the complex and sometimes contradictory roles of women in the Bible? And what are the implications for our people today? All this is the topic of a talk, a public talk being given at University of the Pacific this Thursday. It'll be given by Sarah Schechtman, who's a biblical scholar and an expert on women in the Bible. Sarah Schechtman, welcome to Insight.
Hi, thank you.
Well, I guess from a feminist perspective, the Bible does not get off to a good start given that Eve is made out of a rib from her husband. How do things change from there, if they do?
Well, you know, there, feminist scholars have actually made a lot of progress in terms even of that first creation story, which is actually the second. There are two creation stories, one in Genesis 1 and then the one in Genesis 2 and 3, where Adam and Eve are created. And a lot of feminist scholars have looked even at that picture and seen that if you're talking about creation moving from sort of the chaotic to the fully completed, then the woman as the last thing that's created is actually the pinnacle of creation, in a sense. And then the unfolding of the rest of the story, where Eve is, tempted by the snake and eats the fruit of the tree of knowledge, feminists have looked at that story also and seen it as an example of her showing intelligence and curiosity and a desire for knowledge, and put a positive spin on that. So even just starting with those early stories from a feminist perspective, you can really see a positive, you can have a positive take on it. And then the same thing for a lot of other stories in the Bible. I think there has been a tradition of interpretation that sees women in subordinate roles and as having a specific place in society that's beneath that of men. But feminist scholars have done a lot to look at it from a different direction, to look at the stories from a different direction, and to try to understand what positive roles the women have and what strengths you can see in the role that they play in Israelite society.
Well, those are positive takes on the role of women in the Bible, but do you think that those takes were shared by the people who wrote the Bible in the Holy Lands thousands of years ago?
I think that the important thing to keep in mind is that the Bible was written over a long period of time and by a number of different people, and so you see different views of women's place in society reflected in the text. And so certainly in some instances it does seem that there is a more negative view of women taken, and even in the most positive spin, women still have a subordinate role to men in the Bible. That it's never a fully equal position, certainly, because we're talking about a culture that was really a patriarchal culture in sort of the truest sense of that word. But it's important to keep in mind that women's status probably changed over the course of the period in which the Bible was written, which was, you know, hundreds of years. And so it looks, from some of my research at least, like in the older period, perhaps women did have a little more status, and they just would have played more important roles in society. They would have been able to exercise a little bit more authority locally within their families, even within their towns, perhaps. And then as you get into a later period, maybe that role became more restricted. And so the different authors reflect those different views based on when they're writing.
My guest is the biblical scholar Sarah Schechtman, who'll be talking about women in the Bible at University of the Pacific in Stockton this Thursday evening. Are there any women in the Bible who are unambiguously strong, independent characters? You don't need to have an optimistic interpretation of their role in the Bible. There's just no question about it.
Sure. I think that, say, Deborah in the book of Judges is a very positive character she's a military leader. She's called a judge. She's called a prophetess as well. And the text has, you know, nothing negative to say about her, basically. You can also look at Ruth in the book of Ruth, who is a very strong protagonist as well, and is depicted very positively in the narrative. And there are, I think, you know, numerous other examples that you could see there as well.
Mm-hmm. How many, if any, of the people who wrote the Bible were women? Do we know?
So, no, we don't know. There is some debate about that. Part of the problem with a lot of the Bible is that the authors don't identify themselves, right? They're, even in the books like Isaiah or Jeremiah, the prophetic books, where ostensibly the prophet that the book is named after and whose prophecies are recorded in the book is the author, they don't always say that they're the author. They don't usually say that they're the author. And then those are clearest cases, right? Then there's places like any of the books of the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, where there's no mention of who the author is. There's some mention of Moses writing some parts down, but not all of it. And so we don't know who the authors are. And when you don't know, it's really hard to say, could a woman have written this, or must a man have written it, right? The default assumption is that men wrote all of the Bible. And so some scholars have looked at the text and tried to discern here and there where you might be able to say a woman could have written this. And a few examples, some people think that the book of Ruth actually could have been written by a woman because it explores a woman's world quite intimately and seems to have a fair degree of sort of verisimilitude, according to some people. Mm. Some scholars think parts of the Song of Songs, or the song, which is sometimes called the Song of Solomon, could have been written by a woman also. Some of the love poetry there could have been. The most sort of infamous example is Harold Bloom's Book of Jay, in which he thinks that the Yahwist strand of the Pentateuch, so the J source of the first five books of the Bible, which are considered by scholars to have been composed of several sources that were edited together, one of which is this so-called J source. And Harold Bloom suggests that the J author was a woman, but that's an idea that was, I think, meant to be sort of titillating in some way, and that scholars for the most part have not taken up that idea.
Yeah.
It's just ultimately, I think, impossible to say with any kind of certainty who wrote any of the books of the Bible.
Well, since the Bible was written, countless women have read it. But at the time the Bible was being written, which was, as you said, over a long period of time, do you think the authors intended women to read it?
Well, there's some, I mean, it depends on the parts of the Bible you're talking about. I mean, some parts of the Bible, it seems, may have come from oral traditions that were told sort of like campfire tales in various, you know, in the home or in the town at gatherings. And there, you know, women and men both would have been listeners, children, you know, everybody would have been gathered around and would have known these stories. And women may even have created some of those stories. That's one of the places in which you can start to look for female authorship as well, that if there are stories that in oral traditions might have been stories that women told. Certainly in parts of the Pentateuch, there are also statements about the law parts of that text being read publicly to everybody, to all of the gathered Israelites, including women. So it seems that there is some intention, at least for parts of it, to be read by or heard by, right? Most people wouldn't have been literate, so very few people actually would have been reading these texts.
Yes.
But for it to be read out loud to an audience that certainly would have included women.
Finally, Sarah Schachtman, is discussing and analyzing the role of women in the Bible simply an academic exercise, or does it have some repercussions for today? Because I'm guessing that the role of women in, for example, the Catholic Church today is determined by the interpretation of the role of women in the Bible.
Absolutely. I think it does have repercussions, not only in specific religious denominations where, as you said, in the Catholic Church or in other churches or in synagogues or wherever, you have women who are kept out of certain kinds of, especially clerical roles, but various kinds of leadership roles. A lot of those, for Christian movements, a lot of those are based on some New Testament texts, rather than texts from the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible, which is the area I specialize in. But also there are... In Jewish communities as well, there is a tradition of sort of separation, and women are not ordained as rabbis in certain in some Jewish movements as well. So certainly there, you know, that a lot of that depends on traditions of interpretation of the Bible, and you can look through the Bible itself and see counterexamples where women do have leadership roles. And some people use those as, you know, as counter arguments to say that women should be ordained in these movements. But yes. I think also in a secular society, right, we live in a society in which, despite it being nominally secular, the Bible is incredibly influential and it plays a huge role in a lot of social issues. And so the understanding not just of the place of women, but of all people and what various biblical texts say on all kinds of topics is really extremely important. And I think it's very important in particular to recognize the diversity of voices within the text, that yes. There is no single the Bible says. There are many things that the Bible says.
Sarah Schachtman, biblical scholar. She'll be discussing women in the Bible at University of the Pacific in Stockton. It starts at 7 p.m. That's on Thursday, April 7th. The talk is open to the public. Sarah Schachtman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, poets who condense their work into the 140-character limit of Twitter. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Haiku shows us that short poems can be powerful and lyrical, but even haiku can seem a little wordy when compared to Twitter, where everything must be 140 characters or less. Some poets have embraced that challenge, and you can read their work in a new anthology. All the book's poems and stories are tweets. On a Narrow Windowsill was published by Folded Word, which is a small press based in Rockland. The poets, the writers who contributed to the book come from all over the place. In our studio is the managing editor of Folded Word Press, J.S. Graustein, and she's also one of the co-editors of the book, Also with us on the phone, Rose Auslander, who's a poet and fellow co-editor of On a Narrow Windsill. And another one of the poets featured in the book is in our studio, Ellarine Lockie. Jesse, Rose, Ellarine, thanks for joining us on Insight today.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Hi.
Jesse, what gave you and Rose the idea to pull together all these tweets that are poems and make them into a book?
Well, we originally published them on Twitter as Twitter zines is what we called them. So for a couple of years, we've been asking people to submit, and then we edit, we look through them and either accept or reject ones that we would like to publish, just like a regular magazine would do. And so after a year, we wanted to put them together and have them live and breathe on the printed page.
Rose, how many tweet poems have you written?
How many tweet poems have I written? Well, I've written more than I've published. So, you know, I've probably published, oh gosh, maybe 15 or so.
And when you say published, you mean published in the sense of posted on Twitter or published on in an actual book?
I mean in the sense of posted on Twitter, but by a press, not just myself on my own Twitter feed.
And Ellarine, what about you? How many tweet poems have you written?
Well, I write a lot of haiku and senryu in the short verses, but Twitter is actually quite new to me. I had not heard of it when Jesse contacted me and asked me if she could use a few of my haiku on Twitter, and I had assumed it was some kind of bird aviary related journal. And I said, well, sure. And I said, by the way, what exactly, you know, where is it? Where can I find it? And so that was my introduction to Twitter.
What's the difference for you between writing a haiku and a poem in Twitter? Haiku has a very fixed structure. They're short poems, but they have that, I think it's five-syllable, seven-syllable, five-syllable structure. With Twitter, you can write as many syllables as you want, but it's got to be 140 characters or less, including spaces.
Well, haiku, they call it twaiku, actually, I think, fits very nicely into that because it's for 140 or less. So haiku is perfect. And so is tanka. That's another short Japanese poem, and I write in both those forms.
Well, it's time to hear some examples of these poems, these Twitter poems from the anthology On a Narrow Windowsill. And why don't we start with you, Ellarine Lockie, in our studio. Do you want to choose one of yours and read it for us?
Oh, sure. This is a senryu. Glass thermometer beside bottle of aspirin. Perfect attendance.
Oh, my goodness. Aww. That's great. How did you, where did that poem come from? Did it start out as a long, regular poem?
No. It came from a desire to write a haiku, which is a really good haiku should take two images and it should introduce a third scenario that somehow connects those two images. And in haiku, preferably one of the images will be nature. In senryu, it can be people related, which this one would be. Yeah. And so the hard part of it is finding that third connecting element, which is not too obvious, but makes the reader think a little bit.
And fits in this very narrow frame.
Yes.
What about you, Rose Auslander? Do you want to read one of your poems for us?
Oh, yes, I would. And it's a good contrast because, you know, in addition to doing, you know, the traditional haiku short form, with Form Reborn, what we did was open up to poets the thought of having concentrated, condensed versions of other traditional poem forms, you know, such as sonnet, or in this case, a heroic couplet, but I think it came out as perhaps more of an unheroic couplet. And it's called Oh My. Oh, my eye, I do so hate to see the dancers pixel-late, but still they try to entertain with those stray parts that do remain. Oh, my eye, I?
I love it. That seems long for Twitter.
It's amazing. It was Jesse Graustein who edited it, and it's her brilliance that we managed to squeeze it all in there. Yes, it was a challenge. This one actually was originally a much longer poem, and I was never that happy with how it worked in longer form, and it was one where when I did kind of concentrate it for Twitter, all of a sudden I really was happy with it. So that's an example of sometimes you can benefit.
Now, Jesse, you don't have poems in the book On a Narrow Windowsill, but you're going to choose one of your favorites
for us. I have one of my favorites. It's actually in the short story section of the book, but due to the constraints, it seems poetic. And it's written by Ben White, who also edits a Twitter zine. It's called How We Fall. When I was a raindrop, I tasted the air during a timeless fall, felt my symmetry, my beautiful explosion on contact. I was important then.
But the end makes it rather haunting.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Ben is an expert at what is becoming called hint fiction, where you have a story and you have a beginning and an end in this short little format, but it hints at a backstory. It hints at a what's coming next.
We're talking about the new anthology On a Narrow Windowsill, Fiction and Poetry Folded onto Twitter. All of these pieces are 140 characters or less, and it's published by Folded Word, a small press based in Rockland. Ellarine Lockie, it seems that the special challenge about writing poems in this format is that it's not just every word that counts, it's every character. Because if you go one character over 140, you got to cut it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
How does that affect what you write?
Well, it's not that unusual for a poet to have to write with restrictions, because most poetry up until free verse, you know, was in form, some form or other, you know, sonnets, they all have their limitations. So it's not an unusual concept. I think we poets rather like that challenge. A lot of us do.
Rose Auslander, I read that your great-great-uncle Joseph Auslander was the first poet laureate of the United States. What do you think he would make of this?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. I think the role of the poet laureate is to spread poetry. And when I first heard of Twitter, I thought, oh my goodness, it's come along, the ideal engine to spread poetry. So I think he would have jumped on it and loved it.
Well, we only have 2 minutes left, but given the nature of what we're talking about, we have time for a couple more cute poems. So what about you, Ellarine Lockie? Just let's go quickly through these.
Okay, well, this is National Poetry Month, so I want to read one or two little short ones here by other
just
poets.
Just one. Okay. We're out of time.
All right, okay, here's one by Eric Burke, Poem on a Bar Napkin. What are these doodling selves, these parades of cartoons? Low security berths, private rooms, but the doors open.
Wonderful. Rose Auslander.
Okay, this is by Howie Good, and I had to read it because of the title. The title is, You Won't Listen to My Poetry on the Radio.
Well, we will.
So what? It's filled with words that love each other. And that was the poem.
Oh, my goodness. That's astonishing. And we still have a minute left. Jesse, we've got time for one more.
Okay. This is from Patricia Wellingham Jones, who lives up in Tehama. If only these two little words, when repeated throughout a life, have the power to destroy all.
Oh, my goodness me. It's a wonderful book, On a Narrow Windowsill, Fiction and Poetry Folded onto Twitter. In our studio, J.S. Graustein, managing editor of Folded Word, the Rockland-based publisher. And on the phone, Rose Auslander, co-editor with Jesse of the book, and Ellarine Lockie, one of the poets featured. Thanks all for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison, and today's associate producers, Lynn Weaver, Liz Cazares, Christine Guerra, and Sosin Morar. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. We'll be back tomorrow. How is technology changing legal practice? On the next Insight, we'll talk about that with a local law professor. Also, a visiting ethics expert on ways to deal with some of the big ethical dilemmas of our time. And we'll get the latest on Sacramento's arena and sports team challenges from columnist Marcus Bertone. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.